It is 110 days until the Vancouver municipal election. This is the Cambie Report. I'm Ian Bushfield.
I'm Patrick Meehan.
And today we're joined by...
Patty Backus.
Welcome to the show, Patty.
Thank you.
Before we jump in, we have a couple announcements. First up, our next live show is coming up on July 19th. We're going to be at the Belmont downtown on Granville at Nelson, I think, roughly. Google it.
Granville and Nelson, yes. And our last show was did have some accessibility barriers, and so we've made sure that the Belmont is accessible for individuals that aren't able to handle stairs. But we would ask that you get in touch with us in advance if you can, because the venue would like to know how many people are going to use the elevator over a window of time.
Like all good old downtown Vancouver old buildings. It has an elevator.
It has an elevator.
Try to RSVP on Facebook or Eventbrite. We're making this a pay what you can sliding scale, suggested $5, but if you don't want to or have $5, that's cool. Come on out. Show will get started shortly after 7:30, so try not to be too late. Thanks also to everyone who's been supporting us on Patreon. We got our first check, which is awesome. Though we do want to make a quick little note. We've had so many wonderful people come forward as patrons, and awkwardly, some of them are also running for council.
This was something we didn't see coming somehow. We didn't anticipate this.
But we should have.
Definitely
a lot of
have.
Our main listeners have been the various people considering running for council, and we appreciate that support. We are going to continue to provide our own approach to editorial control beyond what anyone gives us. If we do bring someone on, I think, who is a patron, we'll try to disclose that as a way to be fair. And if people have concerns about that, send us an email.
Yeah, absolutely. We are reaching out to people that we know in journalism to ask for their advice on sort of how to go about this process. And we're definitely going to learn as we go.
But let's jump into this. We're going to talk about the Vancouver School Board with you, Patty. And then we're going to jump into a roundup of other news and hopefully not run too late. But thanks, everyone, for listening after your Canada Day weekend. Matthew sends his regrets. He had a little too much fun on Vancouver Island this weekend, I think. But first up, Patty, you're currently the Georgia Strait K-12 columnist on education issues. You've written for Vancouver Observer and numerous other places in the past, but I think most people probably know you as the longest serving chair of the Vancouver School Board.
Yeah, that's right. I was first elected to the school board in 2008. And as you may know, the school board is elected during municipal elections when people elect their mayor and council and park board. And they elect 9 school trustees. And then once the trustees are sworn in, they elect a chair to serve for a 1-year term or at any time the board decides to change chairs, which does occasionally happen. So I was elected chair when I was first elected and for 6 consecutive years, which actually I discovered made me the longest serving chair ever of the Vancouver School Board.
That's really neat.
It was exhausting, actually.
I can imagine. So I guess as chair, you run the meetings, I would imagine.
Yeah, so the chair of the board represents the trustees and is the official voice of the board and works with senior management to set the agendas for meetings and ensure that trustees have all the information they need to make well-informed decisions and speaks on behalf of the board, but has no actual powers themselves. So no individual trustee has any decision-making power. You're a representative and you speak on behalf of the elected trustees as a body.
And so what does the school board actually do? Like, what is their authority? What
like, can you decide not to run Math 11 if you want to, I guess?
Good question.
Do you shut schools down on a daily basis? And all
you can. The duties and responsibilities of the school board are laid out in the Provincial School Act. So the BC School Act provides for school boards. It governs how they're set up, and they do vary. It's kind of a mishmash across BC. There are 60 school districts now. In the past, there were more. Some have 5 trustees, some have 7, and some have 9, and that's not always set up the way you would think. So, for example, even though Surrey's the largest school district, it has, I believe, only 7 school trustees, where some smaller districts will have 9. So sometimes that's to do with the geography of the district. So there are some very large geographic districts. In Vancouver, trustees are elected in the at-large system. Mm-hmm. So each trustee represents the whole city. But there are many school districts in BC where you're elected by area. So different areas will elect 2 or 3, and then you altogether become a board. So it's a little different than the city council set up, and people don't often realize that. In the School Act, it lays out the duties of the school board, and the school boards have It's an interesting, they're accountable, of course, to their constituents, and but they also have obligations under the School Act. You know, for example, one of them that is to submit a budget by the
end of June, each,
a balanced budget by the end of each June for the coming school year. And as we quite famously did not do in 2016 and were fired. So there are obligations, and the Minister of Education has quite broad powers over school boards, and that was actually amended by the former Christy Clark government to expand those powers. So the minister can really intervene anytime he or she believes it's in the public interest to do so, and give directives to boards or appoint official trustees to direct them or give them, you know, tell them to do things. So they have to, when your questions about, you know, whether we can cancel math when you're no, the curriculum is a provincial jurisdiction. So the province sets a curriculum, and that even applies to independent schools as well as public schools. So they have to follow the curriculum. There are the actual number of minutes of instruction per year are laid out according to the School Act. But school boards have some discretion in how they do that. They can adjust their calendars. They can have longer days, or some might have a 4-day week, or Vancouver played around with, you know, shorter, longer spring breaks, extra days off to save some money in places. But ultimately, you have to have a set number of minutes, and the curriculum has to be taught at all grade levels. School boards decide whether they're going to open schools, close schools, but they're also very dependent on the province for all their funding. So if you say, I might want to say we want to open a new school in the Olympic Village, which we should have and still need to do, but there's no money for it. So school boards set their priorities to go to government. And a big part of a school board's obligations are to be advocates for their districts and to say to government, this is what, you know, our schools need. This is what our students need. There's some unique factors that you need to consider in terms of how we're funded or supported. So there's a broad range, but, you know, I won't go into minute details because I'll really bore people. But it's according to the School Act. So right. It's really two levels. They call it a co-governance relationship, where the school boards and the ministry are supposed to work together and collaboratively. That relationship has been a challenge for many years.
So when you build your budget, it's really looking at sort of like how many schools keep open. The issue of the last two decades really has been how many schools to keep open, I guess.
That's a piece of it, but that's actually a fairly small piece. So we would get our budget allocations from the government in mid-March of each year. Our senior management team would draft up a budget proposal for the trustees' consideration. Trustees would say, you know, go develop a budget, put the needs of kids first, bring us your budget, and we'll look at it. And lo and behold, year after year, the increased costs of operating the district, just inflationary costs, collective agreement increases, would increase a couple of percentage points, and funding would increase usually a little bit, but often not as much as that gap. So government would spin out the numbers saying, well, more funding than ever. We've increased funding. Well, yes, they did. But just the inflationary costs alone would often exceed the amount. So we'd always seem to find ourselves with a gap of, you know, a few million dollars. Sometimes it would be two or three. Sometimes it would be 16 or 17. 2016, we were looking at over $20 million to keep doing what we were doing, just to keep services. Mm-hmm. So we'd have to look at our budget and think, how can we save some money? And year over year, you'd carve away. So it might be teaching positions. I know when the Liberal government first came in and they stripped the teacher's contract, and which ended up in the massive court case. What that really was it enabled school boards to cut a lot of teaching positions they couldn't have if those contracts had been in place.
Is that so, basically through ramping up class sizes?
Yeah, you could increase class size. They did move class size limits over into legislation, into the School Act. And where some of it was, could increase class sizes, but almost more importantly was class composition limits. So suddenly you could have an unlimited number of kids with special needs designations in a classroom, where under the previous contracts, it was different in each district because there was local agreements. But in Vancouver, there were very quite clear limits. How many students with special learning needs per classroom. And if you had over a certain amount, you had to provide a bunch of other supports and services. So it worked well for students and the learning environment.
And that would take the form of like an SEA in the classroom, right?
It could be, some other supplementary non-enrolling staff, resource teacher time. It could often sometimes be negotiated, but ideally you bring the class sizes down to reflect the needs of the students. And sometimes that requires different organizations where you might see some split classes. If you have one particular cohort year with a higher number, you might want to split those and do some splits just to balance out the needs in the classroom. So there's a number of ways to approach it. So when that was done, you could, and I look historically, I know Vancouver that year, I think they cut 200 teachers because they could.
Wow. Oh, wow.
Yeah. That year, the same year they stripped the contract, Vancouver, they also gave the teachers a legislated contract with a salary increase, but they didn't fund it. So school boards had to find the money. In Vancouver, that was the largest shortfall year. 2002 is when I started really paying attention to Vancouver school board politics, and I had young kids in the system, and I was quite alarmed because they had an over $25 million shortfall that year. And that's when they came in, they cut teachers, they cut administration, they cut supervision aides, they cut, you know, the people who supervise the playgrounds, they cut custodial time, they, you know, so all kinds of cuts in the system. And that has repeated year after year after year under the former government. And it became more and more difficult each year to find other ways to save. And that was part of the pressure to close schools. And government, because particularly after it became apparent that we had a lot of seismic upgrades that needed to be done in Vancouver. And I was part of the group that lobbied for that successfully. And the huge bill that, you know, is outstanding, probably, I would say, you know, hundreds of millions still needs to be done in Vancouver. A good way to get a shortcut on that is just to close some of them. So government was saying, you know, you've got some of these schools aren't full. Some of them are only 60% capacity. Why not just combine them and condense them and close a few? And then, oh, if you sold some off, you'd have some money and you could do this with it. So that became a real tension point between the school board and government. And we certainly looked at that, and we went out and had some consultations in communities in 2010, and real opposition, really strong opposition. Yeah. And there were some key folks who really fought hard against closures. And I would say probably the most high profile of them is now the Minister of Health, Adrian Dix, who, you know, campaigned on saving Gladstone and Carleton.
Yeah, he had the various open houses at each of the schools.
He led that. He had signs. He was canvassing with students all summer. So, you know, obviously things have now changed with a new government, and but a lot hasn't really changed. So it's an interesting time in education.
So when are school board meetings, I guess?
Typically they're Monday nights, 7 o'clock. Usually in my day, there was two a month.
And is attending a board meeting the best way to get involved in the school board if someone has a passionate issue? Or is wanting to run? Well, we were speaking with Andrea Reimer, and she talked about coming to council is actually like the last step and not very helpful sometimes. Sometimes it's a lot better to go to the committees or some of the other things much earlier in the process.
Definitely. The Vancouver School Board has a really strong tradition in its governance process of standing committees. It has five standing committees that meet monthly, and that's really where the guts of the work is. And that's where most business that's coming to the board will go through the committee process first. And so it's a less formal environment. It has around the committee table, there are representatives from all of what we refer to at the school board as stakeholder groups. So all of the employee groups each have a representative. There's a student representative. There's parent representatives. And the trustees, there'll be a number of trustees, senior managers. So there's a lot less, you know, there's a chance for an informal discussion. I found it as a trustee incredibly valuable because it's when you hear from other people other than your management team telling you what to do, which is always important. But I would like to hear from the people who decisions were going to affect.
Right.
So if they were recommending we cut something or add something, I'd want to turn to the teacher rep or the, you know, if it was a building issue, I'd want to hear from the engineers, the building engineers, you know, what do you think of this? And students were often had really good insights about, you know, what our priorities should be. And they weren't always what some of us older people around the table thought. That's where a lot of the really richer discussion, and that's where the public, if members of the public want to come and address the board, that's where they do it. They don't generally allow public delegations at the formal board meetings. The formal board meetings are much drier. They're procedural. Most of the issues have been worked through committee, and they come and they're pretty much already almost completely decided. There can still be debate, and sometimes there's interesting debate. Often there is not. But that's sort of the formal rubber stamping decisions that are pretty well. And you know, when things are working well, and they usually do, most of the decisions are kind of consensus by that point. We've worked through, and the committee process allows, if there's bumps or problems with a proposal, it allows a chance to kind of work it out and find a way to make it something that most people can support or all the trustees ultimately can support, ideally. So it's a really valuable process. I think it's being reviewed, which concerns me, and I know there's been push in some of the interventions we had from the former government. They don't like that process because it gives voice to other people than them, our managers. But I think it's incredibly valuable. And I certainly, as a trustee, I found it really helpful to make decisions that I felt were informed.
Neat. So your school board never closed any schools, correct? In that 8-year run or what have you?
We closed one annex that was had no students in it.
So, well, I mean, easy decision there.
And so, we were poised to close a few more. So there were some annexes that were added sort of during the baby boom era that schools were overflowing that were attached to, you know, a few blocks from, but were associated with a main school. So really built for overflow. Over the years, that has overflow has declined. So the school managers have been encouraging people to enroll in the main school and actually sort of passively close the school.
So I know without closing significant schools, like every other district, I think, went through a process of closing a lot of schools. And I know that now a lot of other districts are having problems with the new Supreme Court ruling and the changes to the way the classrooms are operating, that they're now having crowding issues. Do you think that, I mean, I don't want to like clap you on the back and say, you know, good job for not closing schools and seeing this, but is it true that Vancouver is going to be able to weather this change a lot easier because it's got the classroom space now to be able to move into?
Oh, definitely. I think we would have been in a really real bind had we gone ahead with what we were being pressured to do. Just around the time we were fired, we had been going through a process of looking at closing up to 10 schools, including a big high school and a number of elementary schools. And that would have put real pressure on a lot of schools in East Vancouver. And with the restored contract, and Vancouver is interesting as well, is that the old contracts that were restored by the Supreme Court ruling for Vancouver have much tighter language than many districts. So it requires much, in some cases, the language around composition is a lot stricter in the old Vancouver contracts, or stronger, some would say, compared to, say, Surrey or West Van, which doesn't have anything in that area. So they have struggled, and Vancouver has been in violation even this year. They still are not complying, and there's some dispute about what the cause of that is and why it is. But I think the teachers would argue that there are enough classrooms. They just need to start working harder at staffing those and organizing better. And I know the teachers were supportive of the boundary review and sort of using the space we have and using it better to more evenly distribute students. For some reason, the Vancouver School Board didn't even start out, doesn't look like fully trying to staff according to contract, which is, I think, disappointing. And hopefully they'll do better next year. But yes, Vancouver, you know, I'm actually very proud of the fact we sort of held ground. Mm-hmm. And in fact, many of those schools, they're not sitting empty. They were never sitting empty. Those spaces, if you go visit those schools, which I often did, are well used. There's childcare centers operating.
They're rented out, right? For profit.
Used for in some cases, getting out to third parties. There was all kinds of things that those spaces were used for. In a few cases where there were empty rooms that we didn't have an alternative use, they were locked off. They were not clean. Mm-hmm. They didn't actually cost us anything.
Right.
And if you've been paying attention, you'll know that Vancouver real estate has been, you know, we made a lot of money by keeping those classrooms. Yeah. So
and a lot of money annually on rent from Kingsgate Mall as well.
Absolutely. So yeah, and there was a huge pressure to sell off that as well. Mm-hmm. And I look back and think how foolish we would look now if we had sold real estate several years ago and now didn't have it, and we're having a space shortage, people would have thought we were reckless idiots, and we would have been. Yet that was what we were being pressured to do. And if, you know, there were a number of audits that the provincial government commissioned to the VSB, I would argue they should have been auditing the casinos instead of the school board, but
it seemed everyone got audited but the casinos.
We got audited
TransLink got audited a couple of times. Yeah, the Vancouver School Board got audited.
And, you know, it's like, we'll show you the books, guys. They're here. There's still not enough money. And
books are the same as last time you came.
Yeah, same thing. And they'd come back with the same recommendations. Well, you know, if you closed schools and sold land, you'd have money. And I think any 8-year-old could have told us that. But they spent hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars on those reports and were not helpful. They were not helpful.
And I guess in terms of revenue stream, now there's this new issue that came up, I think, a year or two ago and is now back in as this BC Hydro substation. Do you want to give us some context for that? I guess it's a downtown school in question.
Yes. So Lord Roberts Annex is adjacent to Nelson Park. So at Nelson and Thurlow in the Vancouver's West End. So Nelson Park is a really popular, one of the few sort of parks in the West End. It's a well-used park. It's a very dense area. There's a dog park there. There's the public markets there on the weekends. On that site is a small annex site. So sits looks like it's in the park, but it's really owned separately. That's a K-3 annex for about 120 kids approximately. I could be off there. Just over a year ago, last spring, BC Hydro approached the city and the park board and the school board with a proposal to put underground substations under Emery Barnes Park downtown and also sort of on the Lord Roberts Annex site, so adjacent right beside where the elementary school is. There were some negotiations that went on, and ultimately BC Hydro, which put a lot of pressure on and said it was really urgent, they needed decisions, And then suddenly,
the BC government, I think, was happening.
The BC government was
in favor,
pushing very much for it. And then, and I was concerned because at that point there was no elected school board, and so it was all a little interesting. But they Hydro walked. They actually withdrew the proposal. They couldn't come to an agreement with something with the city, and off they went. So that we thought was over. They came back this spring to the school board and wanted to go ahead with the underground substation on the Lord Roberts Annex site. And just last week, the school board voted in favor of selling them an underground parcel of land to do that. So it's been
Confusing to me, the idea of selling underground land.
Yeah. So they have, it's really rights to the underground. Mm-hmm. And really, in effect, they're kind of selling the site because you can't build on top of it. Yeah. You can have a play field that the kids can play on a field. You can put a turf field or a rail field, and but you can't do a whole lot else for various reasons.
So effectively, they're restricting future use of that property on the ground.
That's the, you know, there's like, two big concerns. One is sort of my position when I was a school trustee is that we were stewards of these public assets that belong to communities, should stay belonging to communities. And you could argue that BC Hydro is a publicly owned Crown corporation, but it's no longer school board, has no longer able to either one day build on it or do something. The other piece is a lot of people still have concerns about safety of electromagnetic fields, and I don't know enough about them to really have an informed opinion. I do know parents are concerned, and I've had many parents tell me they would never send their child to spend 6 hours a day for several years sitting beside a substation, buried or not, and whether the physics will tell you that it's maybe safe. And it does seem fairly strong argument that it is, but I don't know. You know, sending a five-year-old enrolling a school. And I know how much parents worry about different things, sometimes with reason, sometimes not. I had lots of parents who were concerned about Wi-Fi when I was first a trustee. Yeah, that kind of diminished over time. But so I don't know. You know, I think that the issue, and certainly for the community, I heard a lot from people in the community. And I went out to a public meeting with residents of Mole Hill, which is a nice little community right adjacent to the park. And they're obviously concerned about the disruption. That's a, I would think it's going to take 5 years to build this substation. So that's a lot of disruption. Oh, yeah,
it's subtle or quick.
It's a big hole. They have to excavate. There will be a number of disruptions to the community in a very dense area that's already got a heavy traffic and, you know, congestion issues and concerns. Lots of people concerned about the safety of having these high voltage cables running through. And now people tell me they're under the streets and they're all over the place. And that may be true. But it was there is the question of the reason the school board went for it, or their arguments, the way they felt, is that the money Hydro was offering them. Now, and it was a bit confusing because when it started, I kept hearing lease. They wanted to lease this site.
Right.
99 years or something, which is what has been done with some other school board lands in the past. But when the end it came out, it was an actual sale. So they're going to own it. That switched somewhere along the process. The money that the school board will get, they say, will be used to build a school in Coal Harbor, which is needed. And that once that school is built, it will be an elementary school on a site set aside by the city. It's been there for a while, right by the community center. That the students who now go to the Roberts Annex will have to all go over to Coal Harbor, which isn't really a long distance, but it is by downtown standards. They're they're crossing some really major streets.
Well, especially for elementary.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
High schools can have a pretty big range, but when
6-7-year-old kids, it's a bit of a hike. A lot of people downtown don't have cars, don't want to be driving. You don't want people driving back and forth across downtown to school. So it's not ideal.
And hopefully they'll name it something better than Center Crosstown.
Don't get me started on that. So once that school is built, should take about, I think they say 2023, it will be ready. So then the students go, then they can demolish the annex and start building the substation. This is a many years project. Once they build the substation, they say they'll use the rest of the money to build a replacement school. Now we're getting way down the road on this now in terms of time. So I think I would say that there's a lot of questions there. I think they're going to try to set up a trust or something so that the money stays there. There'll be new governments. There'll be new school boards. Mm-hmm. So if I was a West End parent or planning to be, they don't have people who are going to be parents there then probably don't know it yet. But the people who will end up being parents there in 2028, 10 years from now, who have young kids that want them to go to the local school, you know, I don't think there's much there to assure them that school will actually happen because it may, but other priorities come up. And my experience as a school trustee is that government knows where you have money, which accounts it are in. And when you need money, they'll say, go use that money for that. So when you say, we need to go seismically upgrade school over there, they'll say, well, you've got that money sitting in that account. You can use that and you go pay for it yourself. So it's a bit of a concern because it's government's responsibility to fund building new schools. And Cole Harbour has been on the Vancouver School Board's capital plan request for several years. Government had indicated it was supporting that project. And then when they heard about the hydro proposal, they said, oh, yes, we're supporting it, but we're not giving you any money. You'll have to use that money.
But so, here's how you fund it.
So, you know, I would say if I was living downtown and living near that park, I'd be saying, how come we had to take a substation? No other community in BC has been asked to accept a buried substation by their elementary school in order to get the other school they need. So it does set, I think, a concerning precedent. Are we going to start selling off school lands? And what's to stop them from wanting to do more of these? What's to stop government from saying, you know, go ahead and sell something, or, you know, those annexes that you closed and you're renting out, now why don't you sell those lands and use that to pay for your upgrades? So it does concern me that this board, and even the current chair of the board, Janet Fraser, was quoted in media saying she was angry and frustrated that they were forced into this decision. I was forced into some decisions, but I don't think I ever made decisions that I truly couldn't justify. So it's not a great situation when you have a school board chair saying they were forced into a decision that makes it sound like it was a pretty bad decision if they're angry about the decision they made.
Well, so I guess they can vote.
Yeah, I mean, I would have voted no. You know, I would have voted no and gone back and said, we need that school. We need to find another way to fund it. Their MLA, Spencer Chander Herbert, had been out speaking at the board saying he would be right there with them fighting for that school and make sure it gets built. And in my experience, often that's how the negotiations go. They really push hard to get you to try to do something else. But, you know, despite my own battles with the last government, I signed more funding agreements than probably any trustee ever has in Vancouver. So they do come forward. You just have to, sometimes you got to do the tough negotiations. Right.
So before we switch gears into other news and away from the school board, why don't you just sort of ask, what are you looking for going into this year's school board elections? Are there any other issues you see on the horizon? I think redistricting of the schools has been something that's been percolating for a while. And are there any candidates you think are standouts?
Well, it's an interesting time because we have a board that's split now among four parties, which is new. So it's there's NPA trustees, two NPA, three Vision, three Green Party, and one city. So that's new. It's the first time there's been an elected one city trustee. And I would say Carrie Bursick is one city's only trustee. And I would say there's no question she's been the standout on this board. And I say that as a former Vision trustee, much as I love my old Vision colleagues and they're I consider them friends. But Carrie has by far been the trustee who's really talking about students and standing up for students and pushing hard for making decisions that are always in students' best interest. When you're a trustee, there's a lot of competing pressures. The adults in the system get very well represented. And often things are, you know, benefit adults, benefit, you know, they're easy to do for management or government wants them, but they're not always in the interest of kids. So someone at that table, and ideally all nine of them, needs to be thinking about, you know, how is this really going to affect kids? Is there a way we can do this better so that students who need support are getting it? And I would say Carrie has been consistently the trustee who has done that. Others have been good. The big issues, certainly this year, they started a catchment boundary review. Now, catchments in BC, again, according to the school act, every home in the city is in a school catchment. So you're assigned, depending on where you live, your local elementary school and local high school, and there's boundaries and maps that show. So whatever street you live on, that's your school. And sometimes that boundary can run right down the middle of your street. And if you live on the other side, you go to the other school. Doesn't always mean you go to the nearest school. You might be three blocks from one on one side, but your actual school is seven blocks the other way. But they try to, you know, make it make sense. Over time, of course, we have kids where we don't have enough schools, and we have more schools than we had need for kids in other parts of the city. And we have some areas, like particularly the middle of the city now around Olympic Village, where there's all kinds of families living in great family housing and co-ops, and the school's never been built. Yes, there's a...
Is the site set aside?
The site is there. Okay. It's in the official plan. It's actually the Hinge Park site, but there's been some discussion of moving it. But the city has always guaranteed there would be a site.
Oh, is that the like empty field next to Hinge Park?
Pat lives in Olympic Village, so he's like...
Yeah, I think so.
It's my neighborhood. I'm super interested.
That's where it was supposed to go. I know there was talk about moving it a little further west. That's all a negotiation. But the city generally will make sure there's a site, but we need the money to build the school. Same with Cole Harbour. Government has never come forward with the money to build that school. So what's happened is that area was added to the catchment for Simon Fraser Elementary, which is on 16th, and that school is just bursting at the seams. It's way too, there's just not space. We've had to, or the school board has to hold lotteries each year to see who gets into kindergarten, which really upsets people when they live, two blocks from the school and discover, guess what, you don't get to go there. And the school we're going to offer you is quite a distance away, and you've got to get to work and you've got childcare arranged there. I mean, it's really, really difficult for families when that happens. And that's happening more and more now. There's several schools at capacity. I know from my experience, and I've been around long enough to know, changing school boundaries can be almost as difficult as closing schools, because for some people it is, in effect, like having their school closed. So when I saw the school board managers come out earlier this year with this proposal to do a boundary review, they seemed very casual about it, and they put up a little timeline, and we'll do this, and it'll come by the board on this day.
We'll have two town halls, and it'll be fine.
Yeah, well, they didn't even have town halls. Like, they weren't even having consultation, really. They were sort of doing these like information sessions, but they weren't really feedback. And I thought, you have no idea what you're stepping into here. And they didn't. And unfortunately, most of the senior managers are fairly new to the district and don't really understand Vancouver, which is different.
Because there's been a heavy senior management turnover in the last couple of years, hasn't there?
Yes, that's true for a whole number of reasons. Lots of good people, but generally not with either. They don't have experience in management, or they don't have experience in Vancouver. Right. So, and Vancouver is very different than a lot of school districts. And people in Vancouver, as you know, are highly engaged. There's a lot of very well-educated people who are very active in their communities, who expect to be included in decision-making, and are very knowledgeable about various issues and have a lot of detailed questions about them. And you have to be prepared to work with them and listen and respect and be able to respond to that. And you can't you can't take shortcuts, or you'll get caught up in that. And I saw this whole thing look like a big shortcut to me, and that this is not going to wash with the public. I will be interested to see this play out. And I was thanking my lucky stars I was not one of the trustees.
Of course.
And it really went off the rails pretty quickly. It was, I could see from the get-go it was badly planned. They hadn't factored in some very key things that they should have from the start. They really didn't know. And so they had to postpone it, which kind of delays the problem still exists. And now it won't, they're going to revisit it after the new board is brought in. So this board got off the hook. But
so
what
really
it means,
that makes it an immediate election issue, though.
It does.
Makes it something that,
it does.
Some voters are going to go to a specific candidate, like to the candidates, and say, "This is what's happening to me."
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting.
It does create a lot of uncertainty, and when you have young kids, and it's hard enough living in the city with the affordability issues, finding housing, figuring out transportation, figuring out how to get your kids to school, figuring out childcare. If you have more than one kid, that gets really complicated. So when you throw this in, this kind of uncertainty piece, so even if your kids are only 2 and 3 now, you're already planning childcare and logistics and where you're going to live and if you're going to have one car or not. And you throw this in, and now you don't know where your kids might go to school, and you might not have your kids in the same school, because that was one of the real flaws in this, is that there was no assurance, what they sort of call, for lack of a better word, grandfathering. So if you already had a kid enrolled in your school and then your catchment changed because of this process, there was no guarantee your second kid. Yeah. I would have said, right off the bat, you don't ever do that. You just don't do that. You don't split up the families like that. So you would have to say it will delay the full effect of the, but if you've already got one child, the second child automatically gets to stay. I mean, that was a lot of the opposition. And then the second piece is just the now without a decision, people still don't know. And it really, particularly for childcare, which is a real challenge for families in Vancouver.
That's like before and after school care kind of thing. And I know a friend of mine was telling me about how when she was really worried about Champlain Heights, the annex there getting closed, was that I guess daycare spaces have long wait lists. So I guess if you get moved schools, you then have to go onto a wait list for a daycare space near that school, and you might not get it. But you've got daycare now that's at this now closed school. And I guess the same thing would apply if your boundary gets moved, if your catchment gets moved.
And if you're trying to coordinate, sometimes you have childcare for your preschooler and you want one that maybe can sort of move in and works with your after school care for your older child and that they can move into that. It's just a... So we're really throwing families a whole other factor in. And now that the decision has been deferred, it's brought relief to some, but it's created a whole other level for others. And the concern now, even schools that were not directly affected have not been overfull. So, for example, Mount Pleasant Elementary will now be picking up a lot of the Simon Fraser catchment students. Right. So people who I know who live in Mount Pleasant who have preschoolers are now worried they won't get in because that school is going to be full too. So those schools will fill up quickly. And so it's like a chessboard. You know, when you move one piece, it affects, the impacts are felt. And I really don't think they saw that going in. So that's going to be a challenge for the new board. The getting funding to get schools built issue is going to be a challenge. Particularly, they really blinked on this one with Coal Harbor. So they think, I think from some of the comments, some of them believe that'll make the government feel more friendly to give them more money down the road. I'm not sure it may have the opposite effect if they think, okay, we'll get them to do some more of this. The contractual stuff, I have to say after the previous board was fired, you know, that board had a lot of support for the position it took. It had a lot of support from the major employee groups, the unions, the school board. With the fallout of that, amongst the other flurry of political things that were happening, there were allegations that the board had been bullying the senior managers by asking them hard questions in public meetings. Yeah.
We probably spent another hour talking about that whole carcass.
One of the sort of fallouts of that was the employee groups who'd been there to witness all of this came out with a statement, you know, basically supporting the board and saying this is not true and this is the trustee's job. And that board also kind of smeared the employee groups and the parent groups. It went after everybody except the managers. And so the relationships were really damaged after that, you know, not just between us and the managers, but between employee groups and having the appointed trustee come in and some of the decisions that were made and some of the people that she brought in, you know, so I would say the fallout of that is still very much affecting the operation. So that's going to be a piece is for a new board is how it kind of heals those relationships and
relationship management.
And getting on track with this restored contract stuff. And of course, the teacher's contract expires next year, another year. So when the negotiations start, there are some of those happen locally. There's what they call split of issues with the contracts with teachers and then with some of the support staff unions where school boards do some local. So that needs work. And in the last just over a year, both the heads of the employee services or HR department at the VSB, two have quit or left suddenly. I shouldn't say, I don't know what the conditions were for their departure. So there's not even really someone there right now. There was one left last June, the other one left just a few weeks back, very abruptly and unexpectedly. So they've got some real turmoil in their HR department at a time when they need to be recruiting teachers and competing with other districts for teachers. So they're still really short teachers and support workers in the schools. And that's creating a lot of stress and burnout. And they're losing teachers because of that. I hear from probably every week from someone who messages me saying, I was hired this year to work in Vancouver. They've treated me so poorly. I've been bounced around and this and that. And now I'm getting offered a job in Burnaby. You know, I'm going to go. And they can't afford to be having that happen. They're losing teachers, and teachers are, you know, who came here from other provinces to work are getting frustrated. So they've got to get their act together there. They've got some real challenges with who is running Vancouver School Board. It's really been an issue with what happened with the board I was on and the firing and really the BC Liberals' interference at the Vancouver School Board. They really came in and destabilized the district in a whole bunch of ways that I could talk at great length. It really did some long-term damage, and it's really unfortunate to see that really is still there and how a new board comes in and kind of pulls together and gets everyone going in the same direction, where I would say this year has been, that hasn't been there. That management is still really giving the direction. Trustees are kind of trying to keep up and
trying to learn on the job.
Trying to learn.
I don't think almost none of them, I think, had
There's several that are back. Joy Alexander, that was her second term. Ken Clement had served two terms. Yep. Alan Wong's been there for Asia. Janet Fraser is her second term. Fraser Ballantyne is, I think it's his third time he was elected.
Okay, it is a lot more than
the majority had some experience. You know, and one of the risks, though, when you have no clear majority, and I think this is a bit of a cautionary tale for city council, is when you don't have a clear majority, management is the majority. That can be good in some ways, but it can be problematic in other ways. And so what I saw when there's no kind of consistency, and I heard that from managers when we first had I was chair of a board for 6 years where we had a clear majority and we had a good relationship with our senior managers. In fact, they came back to help us out when all of our managers took off on sick leave. But what I heard from even some of the senior managers when we lost a majority is they said they didn't feel secure. They didn't know who day-to-day. They're getting pressure from trustees and no one's there to say, don't worry, we'll take care of you. Just stick to it. So it creates a lot of uncertainty, and it it does allow the bureaucracy to kind of do its own thing because they know there's no one to say, you know, stop. So that's a real concern that I think people need to keep in mind as they want to see more, you know, less partisan politics. There are some risks as well. There's some benefits to some clarity on sort of what group is setting the agenda, but others would probably have a different opinion on that.
Well, we have a few pieces of news we want to catch up because this last week has been surprisingly busy here in the city of Vancouver.
It never ends.
Well, we do know who a few of the upcoming candidates for school board will be, as well as the Greens City Council and Park Board, as they held their nomination meeting this week. And what was supposed to be a fairly typical...
I thought it was open and shut. I thought I knew who the three council candidates would be. It looked like the park board candidates were fairly easy to spot, and it looked like the school board candidates were fairly simple. I had no idea it was going to turn into like a 4-hour endless meeting.
And out of that came more candidates than they had told the Vancouver and District Labor Council they would run.
Yep.
Yeah, it's the Green Party is a really different breed than your typical political parties, and it's always a little unpredictable.
And so none of us were there, and so we don't know exactly.
I wish I'd gone. I was sitting down. I got home from the renters task force that the provincial government had put on. I was sat down and I was playing video games, and then I saw on Twitter that the meeting was still going, and I was like, I could have gone straight up there,
because it went for
until 11 or something,
4 hours or more. Yeah. And it seems I'm still unclear how they ended up electing more candidates than they had essentially said. So
the executive recommended, as I understand it, I've been trying to piece this together. The executive recommended running more candidates than
They recommended
the VDLC agreement.
They recommended a slate, and yeah, that slate consisted of more candidates.
Yeah, and you know, recommended slates are common in parties, and I can understand why. People get a gut reaction against them, and I understand that. I sort of feel it too. But I do sort of understand the idea that the Greens would want to make sure that their best names that are going to be the most likely winners would get on the ballot.
Although the Greens are also the party that, you know, runs
on politics differently.
And that grassroots democracy. So for council, they put up, no surprise, Adrian Carr and Pete Fry, as well as Michael Weeb and David Wong.
And Michael Weeb, I think, is no surprise. He's a current park board
commissioner,
and he's, you know, a local business owner. He's you know, well thought of. He's always going to events, and it made sense to me. And then they decided to add David Wong, who is an architect and top 2017 Vancouver vote getter and housing affordability critic for the BC Greens in the 2017 BC election. Is that what I've got here?
That is what the Greens told us he is.
Yeah,
I copy pasted stuff right from their press releases, so it'll be a bit glowing. For Park Board, unsurprisingly, Stuart McKinnon, who's their current Park Board commissioner.
And Stuart's been around politics for a long time. He knows what he's doing. He's a known name.
As well as Camille Dumont and Dave Demers. And I don't know if Dave Demers is related to Charlie Demare.
Yeah, I don't know either.
It's a good question, but he's a horticulturalist by his bio. And they're running for Park Board. And then for School Board is, you know, again, no surprise in terms of who we expected. Janet Fraser, who topped the ballots in the last election. And then Estrelita Gonzalez, Lois Chan Pedley, who I actually know through social circles. And the oddest name of them all is Nicholas Chernin.
Vroom, vroom.
Well, and that's the first thing I think of is that him revving around opposing the Point Grey bike lane.
Driving around in a muscle car, revving the engine at anti-bike lane protests. Yeah. And that just seems, and I'm not familiar with him. I don't recall him ever being at any kind of school board meeting ever. So that's, you know, I had no idea he was interested in the Vancouver School Board. And it just seems like an odd fit to me that someone whose profile is driving a muscle car and fighting bike lanes to be a candidate for the Green Party.
I think he's more famous for his brother, who we've talked about quite a bit on this show.
Who everyone involved in Vancouver politics has become aware of at this point.
Glenn Chernin, who was the not nominee for the NPA, but still maybe hanging around there. Mm-hmm. It's not clear. But yeah, like you say, Nicholas Chernin was a part of the Cedar Party when they were both in there. And it'll be interesting to see how and many Greens, including I think Pete Fry even at our live show, have told us, Nick's a great guy. He cares passionately about environmental issues or something.
And they've definitely been planning to be able to say that for a while. And I don't know. I haven't met Nicholas Chernin. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt, I guess, other than the fact that he drives a muscle car protesting bike lanes. In terms of the VDLC thing, I did reach out to Pete Fry to ask him about it. And he said that, you know, the Green Party membership has been skyrocketing. And so they've decided to expand a bit because they think that they've got more room to win, which may be true. This is clearly a bit of a power move on their part to try to, you know, storm council a bit more. Because if they can run four, if they can get four councillors, they're going to be in a pretty strong position.
They also risk now diluting their vote, so yep. it could really bite them as well.
Absolutely.
They do. I think that's has benefited them in the past. They've only had a few candidates, and I think they've been able to plump it by doing that and have better odds of winning. I think this could be a big risk for them. And I think if I was one of the other players, I think of, say, One City, who followed the rules and the agreement and stuck to the numbers they had agreed on, I think they're probably saying, like, hey, what gives? And it's not a great way to go in as we're going to work together as progressives and try to keep the NPA out. Now, I think to some extent, maybe all bets might be off.
So the letter, the agreement,
it allowed for a reopener, I guess.
Yeah, it's
the Greens had the ability to renegotiate the deal, but so they didn't do that.
It hadn't been signed, essentially. None of them had been signed. They were sort of working towards ratifying them through their membership.
And I think everybody but the Greens arrived with the ability to sign a deal on the day. Everybody but the Greens, One City had a special meeting of their membership in order to vote to give their negotiators the authority to sign a deal in place. And so nobody else had to take it back to their membership, as far as I understand it. I could be wrong on that, specifically in terms of there could have been somebody else at play that didn't have that authority. But my understanding was that the Greens were the only ones that couldn't make a deal on the spot.
Maybe cope.
Maybe.
Maybe. But one of the things that's bothered me is the spin the Greens have been pushing on this since, like, this meeting happened. Because even in their press release, they talk about how discussions are ongoing, and I'm sure they are. They were there. They note that Vision, One City, and Cope have all received VDLC support for running more candidates than the VDLC intends to endorse.
Which is true. That was the deal that was signed by everybody.
But that was even true of the Greens.
I think this is asking, I think the best way to put this is it's asking forgiveness instead of asking permission. Yeah. Is that Vision and One City asked permission to run more than, and they got it. And the Greens are now asking forgiveness for running more.
Well, we talked about how Vision was negotiating tough and even went as far as to probably walk away from the table for a bit to see if they could get more. And they got more.
Yep.
But now the Greens are kind of doing it in reverse and probably work.
Yeah. And I think one other thing to note is that, you know, only 4 of the 11 candidates that the Greens are putting forward are self-identified women. And I think that's, you know, it's close to half, but it's not half. And that's, I think, something that's worth noting, I think, is important for parties to bear in mind and for electors to bear in mind.
I have to see how the Greens pull out of this. I know a lot of people on Twitter immediately kind of picked up that line of, well, Vision's running 5, but VDLC is only going to endorse 4, so why can't the Greens run more? I'm like, well, because they literally wrote an agreement saying they wouldn't.
And I was kind of trying to understand, I was thinking, like, what's motivated this? What's this coming out of? Were they, you know, there was some speculation I heard that they were concerned that some of their incumbents, and they didn't provide incumbency protection, what's other, some other parties do. So without incumbency protection and knowing the churn and sign up ability, were there concerns that people who they, most of the Green Party wanted to see nominated and assumed would have been, might be at risk? Or was there something else going on? And I'm not clear on what led up to this interesting decision to go in this direction. I think you'd have to know what the numbers were in the nomination vote and how they shook out, or, you know, how what people were concerned about going into that vote and how they thought they might be affected if they didn't have more seats.
Yeah, I think nomination races can be kind of silly season. People get a little bit over out of their heads, and they start losing their sort of perspective. And I think you could definitely see individuals really banding together to try to expand that list just because of personal fears or personal worries about their ability to get on the ballot. I think that's a good point.
Well, and a lot of nomination meetings end with that motion to destroy the ballots and say, we're all behind this person and or this slate as a way to show unity and sort of, you know, dispense with the animosity, and that means we'll probably never actually know the answer. The thing that still is interesting for me is just this slate of running more, or this idea, and only one person who got elected wasn't on the Green exec slate. I believe it was Camille Dumont, but I'm not sure.
I remember
it was only one, but that decision to essentially not adopt the VDLC agreement as it was recommended by the Green negotiator doesn't seem to have gone to a vote of the Green members, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, it's weird. But I mean, the Green Party municipally has never really been all that internally democratic. They oftentimes have named their slates before and things like that. So it's
sometimes
not
out of necessity, probably.
Oh, yeah, but, for sure.
Well, it's not the only party that's in the news this week. The Hector Bremner Party is officially Yes Vancouver.
Such a stupid name.
That's already another organization madly tweeting, oh, it's not us.
Absolutely.
And it's I don't know how they didn't Google that and do a little research first.
And it's an organization that's primary goal is to like advance the cause of women in business. And so it's a like it's a good or like in Vancouver. And so
I'll note that Yes Vancouver, the organization, has an exclamation mark in there. So maybe it is distinct enough.
I went on a bit of a Twitter thread about, you know, times politicians have named things stupidly. And I sort of remarked on when the Reform Party merged with the Canadian Alliance and they, at first vote of plenary, named themselves the Canadian Reform Alliance Party, which immediately had a bit of an acronym problem. And it took them until the next day to change it. And, you know, there's been other instances like that. I think political parties are pretty, they can be pretty brain dead to Googling things like this. Like when the BC Liberal leadership race was set on the same day as the Super Bowl.
Which they did move.
But like it's, maybe they just didn't care. Maybe they Googled it and they just didn't care. Or maybe they just didn't Google it.
I am hopeful Yes Vancouver, the charity, gets a few more donations. They sound like they do pretty good work.
This can be a pretty good exposure tool for them.
You know, but they are publicly saying, and they pinned the tweet, that they're not affiliated with the Bremner Party, essentially. The other half of the announcement that was interesting was they announced who's going to be on the board. And so this will be the people who put together all of the boring paperwork of how this party works. And there's not names I recognize on there.
It's more diverse than I thought it was going to be.
There's people like Howard Grant, who's with the Musqueam Band.
Yeah. I think there's three Indigenous peoples. Two or three on their board of directors, and that's pretty good. Like not like you know it's nice. Yeah it's they're it's not an all white guy party, right?
Yeah, it's three women and six men.
He had Wade Grant was going to run for council.
Yeah, that's what it was seeming
Wade's,
like.
Yeah, Wade's a pretty impressive candidate.
But yeah, it's not just diverse in terms of, you know, having a few Indigenous and at least a few women, but it's not gender parity. It did look like a fairly diverse set of backgrounds. It's not just nine developers.
which was the brand that people were already applying to them. Yeah. Well, I mean, we'll see where they go. It looks like they're going to have a candidate nomination race sometime in July, and it should be interesting to follow that.
Yeah.
They'll be running fast.
They have to. Yeah. So the one thing that you're required to do, I think, if you're going to run for council in Vancouver, Jean Swanson managed to do it. She's joined a long line of people now to get arrested protesting the Kinder Morgan Kinder Morgan pipeline, which I guess we should stop calling the Kinder Morgan pipeline since Kinder Morgan doesn't own it anymore.
It's the Government of Canada Trans Mountain Public Pipeline.
Our pipeline.
Our pipeline.
We all own a little piece of it.
But yeah, she protested within the exclusion zones where the injunctions are. Like anyone else now faces up to 7 days in jail, some amount of fine.
We talked about Kennedy Stewart did it earlier along with Elizabeth May. Yeah, I mean, this is going to be the story for the summer as they continue this process. Like, this is not going to get easier.
I don't think it really, I question how much it sort of impresses people. I don't know that it's that useful. Yeah. I mean, great, go for it. Good for Jean, but I'm not sure it's a winning strategy for, you know, you vote for me, I can get arrested.
I think what it does is impresses the kind of people she needs to build her campaign. So it's not that...
Energizes the base.
Yeah, it's not that people are going to vote for her because she got arrested or anything. It's that people are going to go door knock for her.
Right.
And
right,
talk about how strong she is. So maybe... Because it's early enough that you're not trying to build your full electoral coalition yet. You're trying to just make sure you have people to sign people up. Especially if you're an independent, you're just trying to count ballots.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's important.
People who are not trying to count ballots are all of the outgoing mayors on the mayor's council who have decided to charge everyone in the city more for gas.
Well, not necessarily. The province came at the last minute with the ability to raise the gas tax by a cent and a half per liter. And the mayor's council haven't necessarily voted to do that, but they voted to take the role and probably do it. It's almost for sure going to happen.
But the good news here is this is filling the last bit of the funding gap for...
We finally paid for the 10-year plan we've been trying to pay for 10 years.
So this includes the Broadway subway that will go as far as here, Arbutus.
Yep.
some of the Surrey LRT.
25% increase in bus service hours, as well as a massive increase in Expo Millennium, Evergreen, and Canada Line service. You're looking at more frequent off-peak service on the C-Bus, as well as probably, and I haven't seen it in writing, but I've seen it in the pictures, probably the SFU gondola, which I'm really happy with. I'm just really happy to see it finally happening. And I know the mayors are too. This really was there. A lot of them are leaving office and not running for re-election, and they really wanted to see this through.
But will this increasing gas tax become, or potential increase in the gas tax become something especially suburban voters get angry at? One of the BC NDP things.
Probably. People hate gas tax for, yeah. And gas taxes aren't the most efficient way to charge for mobility. And it's also it can be fairly regressive because, you know, if I'm rich, I'm buying a Tesla. And if you're not rich, you're buying a Tercel that's from 1998. And so your gas mileage is infinitely more than mine because I'm on a Tesla. But not that I own a Tesla.
Or a car at all.
Yeah. But, you know, this pays for the thing. And I'm just happy it's now done.
Well, over in Burnaby, there was a bit of a surprise, not endorsement or actual endorsement this week. The New Westminster. You said Northwest.
Don't know how I said the Northwest District Labor Council. I've been to the meetings with them. I know people that are involved. My mother was a union president for 5 years in that region. I have no idea how I said Northwest District Labor Council three times in the podcast.
Or how I missed it when I was editing. I was just like, I wonder where that's located. I just assumed you knew what you're talking on labor stuff. But the NWDLC ended up, for the first time, not endorsing Burnaby Citizens Association candidate Derek Corrigan, who's been the mayor there forever, and instead are endorsing former retired fire chief Mike Hurley for mayor of Burnaby. And they're not endorsing any sitting councillors.
I think this demoviction thing is really going to bite Burnaby finally. This has been going on for ages and ages and ages, and it's no one ever talked about it. And I think we're finally getting to a point where Derek Corrigan and his policies are going to actually have political consequences for him.
It's impressive. Just because we haven't done a full Burnaby episode yet. Mm-hmm. We did our Surrey episode finally, and we'll have a new North Shore one coming up soon. Yeah. But the Burnaby Citizens Association has been the NDP party, essentially, at the municipal level there.
Since the 90s.
And, you know, at times, that city was rated the best run in Canada by Maclean's magazine. They looked at it and went, you know, people are happy, they're getting the services, they're not paying absurd amounts in taxes, and it's not being wasted. But somehow, over the years, it's just switched to this tower development model that, if you look at the Metro Town plan they have, which involves destroying Metrotown Mall for towers of condos, which we'll have to get into at some point, but
it's destroyed the region's rental stock. Because a lot of those mid-rise buildings were the backbone of the region when it comes to low-cost rental stock that was attached to transit. So for region-wide affordability, destroying those and putting in expensive condos, even if you're I looked at three proposals that are before council, and they're to build, I think, a combined 800 units, but they're also going to bulldoze 350 units. So you're only adding 450 units while destroying a whole bunch of the low cost rental.
And that's the thing. They're not starting, it's one thing to densify and build up, but they're doing it essentially on the backs of the poorest in Burnaby, which is just radically gentrifying in the worst sense of the
approach. So I think there's also a lot of anger there with the last bargaining agreement between the city and the firefighters. There was a lot of bad blood spilled there over some fighting, over some eliminations of positions. I think there was one position in particular that Derek Corrigan was seeking to eliminate. And he has not made a lot of friends in the last 5 years.
Well, even his refusal to deal with homelessness early on, he was like, not my problem.
He actually said it's a Vancouver problem.
That was pretty brutal. And that sort of dismissive attitude. And I think that sort of sense of arrogance, people just kind of had enough.
Well, and Mike Hurley had his announcement that he was running earlier this week. But like most early announcements, didn't really come with anything other than I will do politics differently, which is what everyone running to defeat an incumbent will say. And it was his first his platform announcement. When Kennedy Stewart announced, he didn't say anything substantive. But already he's racked up probably the biggest endorsement in Burnaby.
It's an important endorsement. Yeah. So there's a lot of support, a lot of financial money can go towards candidates that get endorsed, as people will donate based on endorsements.
And volunteers.
And volunteers.
A lot of volunteers.
I should point out before we move out of Burnaby that the Labour Council did endorse the Burnaby Citizens Association candidate who's moving from school board to council. So they haven't burned the, you know, political party entirely. They're just saying everyone who's currently elected on council and mayor, we don't like them anymore. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, it's I'm going to be fascinated to see this because Derek Corgan has been the mainstay mayor for as long as I have been paying attention to anything in the Lower Mainland. And this may be his toughest race yet.
And there's a chance I may be living in Burnaby by the election. A high chance, but we'll see. But let's go back across the Patello Bridge again to Surrey, because since we talked about Surrey, Rich Coleman hasn't officially announced, but he's been in the news indirectly because this Peter German casino money laundering report, which you talked about on Podkeep Our Land, and I talked about with one Attorney General, David Eby, on Politicos, not to rub that in your face.
Yeah, you got the better get.
All you have to do is call their media office, apparently.
It's true.
But the challenge now is that Rich Coleman was the minister responsible for gaming and gambling the entire time.
He was minister of gaming for 16 years.
And yet this seemed to have all happened under his watch.
Where we became internationally renowned as a money laundering hub for organized crime.
Where the Vancouver model was developed.
Which then laundered the money so it was clean. And then they bought real estate, fueling our real estate problem. And also the organized crime was involved in bringing drugs into the Lower Mainland. So they enabled, like, the BC Liberal Party, not to get too partisan about it, but for 16 years, they enabled and encouraged money laundering on a grand scale that has resulted in fueling two of our worst crises, housing and opioids.
Like, the body count is, I think, Santa Garasino posted a pretty hard-hitting article in the National Observer over the weekend of, you know, really detailing some of the body counts on, and some of the criminal activity associated with this, or apparently associated with this. And this has been a really devastating period, and, mm-hmm. and it's the tentacles and the impacts of this are so wide-ranging and really affect all aspects of our economy now. Yeah. I live, you know, in nice, quiet, leafy Point Grey. Well, I had a loan shark apparently living 100 feet from my house who had a contract out on her, and she was notorious and was ultimately gunned down, but was using her children apparently as human shields. And my kids practice riding their bikes in front of her house and on their scooters. Yeah. In our neighborhood. So, you know, the organized crime is in all communities now, and certainly mm-hmm. the safety aspects of that. I didn't know at the time, of course, that this person was living in my neighbor, had a contract on her, and people were trying to kill her, and as my kid was playing on a scooter in front of her house. But so that's just an example. But the body count, the murders, the people who were the victims of the loan sharks, God only knows what went on with some of that. And then, of course, the opioid stuff. I mean, the overdose crisis has just been, to me, the biggest tragedy, and the extent of that, and the devastating consequences. And that this seemed to have gone on with sort of, whether it was a willful blind eye or worse. And then we start looking at all the donations to the party and where they were coming from and who was making money. Mm-hmm. A lot of people mm-hmm. were making a heck of a lot of money. But a lot of people have really paid for this. So I think we're just at the tip of the iceberg. We really need to know a lot more. And we need to know who did what and when and who's responsible.
So it's deep and close to home for many people in Surrey, where they've seen such a level of organized crime and gang violence that, like, Mario Canseco pulled this past week for his research co and pulled just Surrey and found that crime outpaced housing as an issue there. Yep, where we absolutely. Have our little bubble here in Vancouver where we're like housing. But now you have maybe the guy who wasn't the ringleader, but was the guy who didn't stop it.
Well, and he did stop a couple of things. He stopped a couple of investigations into it, and he stopped and he actively requested that an RCMP officer be disciplined for speaking out about it.
Yeah.
He said he's still leaving the door open for a run municipally for mayor of Surrey in his statement release. And I have to assume this puts him dead on arrival. I have to assume that there's no ability for him to come in and run for mayor at this point with that record.
And he's not even, doesn't even live in Surrey.
He's a Langley guy.
Langley guy going to go into Surrey with this. And I, you know, the number of victims of this, and I think when people start connecting the dots that this real drug war that's been going on in Surrey and so many really kids who've been caught up and what this does to their families and kids who are being, you know, shot and killed, and then some innocent bystanders, of course. I mean, it's brutal. And if people start connecting the dots and seeing that in some way he enabled that or had anything to do with not preventing it when he had many opportunities, I think he's going to have a rough go. And I think he's clearly, his media profile is suddenly pretty scarce. Yeah. He's talked to a few, you know, I think he talked to Mike Smith at the province and got a bit of an easy ride. And
even his constituency office has been closed and lights off for days.
So he's going to have a tough time answering questions in the media, and he would have no way of escaping that if he's running for office.
Well, as the musical Hamilton quoted, someone else was in the room when it happened.
Oh, I've been making Hamilton jokes all day. That's why he's on this one. But yeah, I don't think he's going to run. And if he does, I don't see how this doesn't dog him the whole way. And I imagine that David Eby's not done on this.
I hope not. I think we need to know a lot more. And I, you know, I would love to see Rich Coleman being cross-examined on this. I want to really know what happened. I mean, I think we deserve it. I think we need answers. We need to know what happened. I mean, it's not something you can sort of sweep aside and say we're moving forward and just going to bring in some new rules and people go unpunished. I think we need to know who was making money, and I don't think people are going to be satisfied with a let's just go forward kind of attitude on this one.
The hook I was trying to throw you that just missed was here in Vancouver, in that room with Rich Coleman, was one Hector Bremner working as as his assistant.
Yeah, he was an executive assistant to Rich Coleman at the time in the minister's office. Now, he worked primarily housing, as he says. But I'd have to look into what his, not what his role in the whole thing was. But
sure, and this isn't to accuse him of
anything. No, no, absolutely not. But that's definitely a good question is, you know, was he involved in the gaming file at all when he was working for Rich Coleman, in Rich Coleman's minister's office?
Well, and where was, you know, what was the premier's role? What was Christy Clark's role? Like, there's a lot of people we need to know what really happened. And I think there are, you know, are going to be a lot of people who I'm sure would love to talk and tell their stories who were in the system who weren't able to talk. And I'd certainly like to hear more. And I hope David Eby is going to keep digging deeper on this one.
Yeah, it seems like he is.
Well, we've covered a ton of ground today, but as usual, I guess, as is our latest trend, is to finish with a piece of Vancouver Ottawa, our random facts about the city.
And this one was one that I had never heard of that you came up with.
I was really surprised about that, but it has a school board connection. I didn't run this by you before, but you might know it. It's the Templeton Five I wanted to talk about today. This was the five TAs at SFU who ran into a bit of trouble back in the 1960s. Do you know about this?
I don't recall that.
I'd never heard about this.
I was busy playing with my dollhouse then.
Okay. So back in the 1960s, when SFU was first created as a university, it was known as the most radical leftist campus in Canada, and it was where all the protests started to happen. And they were actually trying to encourage some of their TAs to get out into the community, take part in stuff. At the same time, there was a student at Templeton Secondary School here in Vancouver who handed in an assignment when I think they felt they wanted to push the needle a little. And what they ended up doing was, I don't have this 100% for sure, but they parodied a student magazine and handed this in, sort of mocking the teacher they were handing. Like, it was a bit crossing maybe some lines, maybe not. I wasn't there. The student then faced some academic sanctions, and these TAs felt it was their duty to stand up for the academic freedom of this, I think it was like a grade 11 student. And so they went and started a protest at the school just to...
I miss when people just did that.
Just to, you know, support... Now we just do it on Twitter.
Yeah.
But so these TAs went down to Templeton, supported this student, and then got fired for it because the school said, no, you shouldn't be, you know, running SFU's name through the mud behind this student controversy. That's an academic thing. Let the VSB handle it. And then a massive free speech protest broke out. 2,000 people at one point were signing petitions in SFU's Celebration Square, which was always designed to be a protest square, just saying, reinstate these TAs, this is against their academic freedom, and they got their jobs back.
Oh, interesting.
That's really neat.
And I think one of the things that really helped make sure that they got their jobs back is one of the deans, I think of the arts department, or one of the deans, threatened to resign. And there's just massive student strikes and things. And so all the TAs got their jobs back. And it was just, you know, the campus free speech controversies of today are very different. Yeah. It's just like one, you know, conservative group is trying to bring on some extremist, and some people are like, that person sounds racist. You know, like free speech. Back then, maybe it was the same thing. It was just the left then.
The
I don't know.
The Templeton Five. That's awesome.
As a quick reminder before we turn off the recording, on Thursday, July 19th, we'll be at the Belmont. Make sure to go to Eventbrite or our Facebook page to find tickets and RSVP information for that. Patty, where can people find you if they want to read more of your stuff, follow you on Twitter and that kind of thing?
Well, on Twitter, at Patty Backus. And I'm taking a bit of a break over the summer from my writing my weekly column. Otherwise, I'm on the Georgia Strait site. There's lots of stuff up there that I wrote this year. If they just go to the Georgia Strait and put my name in there, they'll come across a few dozen columns. And I'll be back at it writing columns late August as for back to school. And I'll be out there on Twitter in the meantime, pretty actively keeping an eye on things.
All right. Well, make sure to go find us on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, wherever else you find podcasts. Leave us that 5-star review. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Canby Report. And support us on Patreon, patreon.com/CanbyReport.
Even if you're running for office?
Even if you're running for office, though we may disclose your name in the future.
All right.
All right. Well, signing off, I'm Patrick Meehan.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. Thanks, everyone, for listening.